welcome to another edition of the Advent Iron podcast. I'm delighted to be hosting this one in lovely surroundings here in central London. And joining me today are three amazing people. We've got Emily.
Hi.
And we've got Sarah.
Hello.
And we've got Rowena.
Hello.
All absolute experts in their own field. And rather than me try to encapsulate just how brilliant they are, I'm going to let them do it for themselves. So if you could just take a minute to introduce yourselves to our audience, that would be great.
Hello everyone, my name is Emily Overton. I'm known on Twitter as RMGirlUK. I spout all things records management, so fundamentally a very sad person. and I've been in the business around 15 years or so.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Sarah Clark, and I'm Trial by Truth on Twitter, and Infospectives for my own stuff, blogging, etc. I have a history in cybersecurity, but for the last 5 or 6 years, I've been circling in on and now concentrating on data protection and privacy. So I tend to have a bit of a dual focus, and that's me right now.
Hi, I'm Rowena. You may have heard my voice before on the podcast. I'm a professional data protection nerd who does this not only for profit but also for fun. I'm Miss IG Geek on Twitter. My background was a long time in IT and information security, but I evolved out of the server room and got into human rights focus instead. And I am usually not short of an opinion or two on the subject of data protection.
No, you don't say.
As you can tell from the action in the background there, quite right. So I think what we'll start with is I'd like to look at some of the tensions and the collaborations that could occur, but often the tensions that do occur between the different roles, particularly when we start thinking about data protection, information security and records management, and some of the legislation that sometimes means that we find our organisations being pulled in multiple directions.
I think Rowena's actually quite of a unique kind of person in her skill set. Because the one thing that really gets my goat is people harping on about information security when they're talking about GDPR compliance. Thankfully, Rowena is skilled across both sets and can talk sense in both capacities of InfoSec and GDPR. But the amount of frustrating stuff I see about saying, oh, well, you just have to be ISO 27001 compliant and you've got GDPR sorted.
Yeah, there was fun on Twitter about that recently, wasn't there?
There was fun on Twitter about that. Yes, I do have... actually, quite a few people lately have been coming into data protection from info security, and they're finding, as I found when I did that journey 10 years ago, that the change in mindset required is pretty profound. So with information security, really the focus is on risk to the organisation and the information assets. Whereas in data protection, it's really about balancing the individual's rights and freedoms with society working well and not being a dystopian hellhole alongside the organisational interests. And that's such a massive shift in thinking. It's a really steep learning curve for incomers to the practice. And I think it would be good if there was more emphasis on the rights and freedoms aspect in the general materials and learning and courses and books and everything else that are being shoved out to take advantage of the GDPR goldmine.
Well, just speaking to that very specifically as well, from my journey where I ended my InfoSec career was very focused on governance, risk and compliance. And there's always a hue and cry, where are my metrics, where are my numbers? And it's always numbers. And there's a real challenge for InfoSec itself because people want to shove a conversation about risk into a financial risk management shape. They want a percentage probability, and they want to have a dollar value on their potential outage and downtime and harm. So that, coming from that extreme over to privacy, where there are a lot of risk and harm-based judgments, people used to give up thinking about reputational damage in InfoSec, let alone damage to individuals, not just individually, but collectively and societally over the medium and longer term. I mean, most risk matrices you see that they communicate to boards are bubbles that talk about data risk, huge data risk, doesn't relate at all to people as such. And we've got a long journey to go on to, I think, mature InfoSec. And I think actually the data protection prominence now can help with that, because it's bringing that qualitative aspect back in to the fold again. Nobody, it was always there. It's years, decades, it's been there, but it's not made it onto the board agenda. You maybe had one person doing data protection, even when InfoSec had matured to having a team of 10 or 15 in big companies.
Anything to say that just because you work in information security that you can't be doing GDPR.
No.
Because clearly, you know, you can you have transferable skills and experience that you can take with you. But I can't say much. I started records management, I then evolved into data protection, dipped my toe into information security because I was thrusted into it, because it's like, oh, you understand what I'm talking about, and I'm like,
you do that stuff, yeah.
We need a picture of that expression.
It's just one of those things, you know, sort of like your skill sets can evolve, but you need to do it properly. You need to have the experience before you start spouting off about it. And actually, when you do spout off about stuff, you need to be spouting off about the right stuff.
Yeah. And know when to call in a subject matter expert when you've reached your level of knowledge, rather than continuing to bluff it and potentially doing the wrong thing or saying the wrong thing. And I think the security industry, from my experience, isn't always very good at that, because people want to be able to do everything. And actually, you know, in 30 years, I have learned that I can't know everything about everything, and I do need to go and speak to people who know more than I do and be prepared to give up that talking spoon to somebody who is the expert.
Yeah. The days of the generalist are over. In any firm of any size, people talk about doing security. You have one bloke who does security. Well, I can probably sit down if I was given time and write 100 roles, all of which you could extend to a full-time employee if it was done properly at large scale. So that's always been something that's been a massive challenge. But yeah, humility, to know where your limits are. Rowena will tell you, when I started, I dared start writing on my blog about pure data protection subjects. I used to fret at you quite extensively, didn't I? Say, I don't want to mislead people. I also don't want to damage my own credibility. But equally, I need to learn. So can you just sanity check what I'm doing? I'd probably go an extra mile or three with research compared to many.
And it shows.
Oh, well, bless you. Thank you for that. But I'm open to anybody calling me out.
I think the peer support is absolutely critical. And I think there is a difference between what I've experienced of the InfoSec profession, maybe, you know, 10 years ago and before that, perhaps not so much these days, but in the privacy profession, is that there's a lot of ego in the security profession. Mm-hmm. It tends to go alongside being very clever with technical stuff, and being among people who are by and large not very clever with technical stuff. Yeah, it does produce quite a lot of Dunning-Kruger effect in other areas that are not security, whereas in the privacy field, because we've had this big change in law, and because the profession is still maturing and developing, I think there's a lot more peer support. There's a big network of people, lots of networks of people who have, you know, Twitter groups, Slack groups, forums, and they exchange questions and views, and by and large, even people asking what they think are stupid questions have things explained to them rather than being mocked and called noobs and told to get
muggles,
out of town
and
muggles. Yeah. So, and I think the need in privacy as a profession to consider lots of points of view, to consider the human impact, and to think about balancing risk rather than heading straight for technical controls, as many techie infosec types would. I think that does breed more of a collegial approach than the kind of race to who's the best hacker, which I've seen quite a lot of.
I think that's an important point there, because a lot of infosec people, really they're IT sec people, and they come from a very technical background, and so there is a tendency to immediately look for a technical software, hardware solution to information issues, rather than understanding that actually it's about understanding the information and its consumption and its usage needs and its retention needs, and then look for solutions that are going to enable that. And I saw this some years ago when local government was going through a lot of the sort of IT transformational stuff.
Yeah.
And one of the areas they were targeted was to introduce elements of electronic document and records management systems. And because it has system in it, it got given to the IT people who went out and bought EDRM systems without doing any of the information side of things.
The amount of times that SharePoint is introduced because IT go, ooh, shiny toy, we have the licenses for this, let's see what it can do. Oh, it's got bigger. Oh my gosh, it's got bigger. It's out of control. I think we need a records manager.
That's so true.
There's a slight issue. Everyone can see stuff that they're not really meant to be able to see. I think we might want to talk to the data protection person. We didn't mean it to happen like this.
When all you have is a SharePoint, everything looks like an intranet.
Yes. I think more generally as well, people don't understand the concept of requirements definition. I came through an IT group as well, and I did a lot of change governance and that kind of thing as part of my job. And my first stop with change governance was working out how do we build something that's going to stand the test of time. What kind of taxonomy do we need for this? Where do we feel around the edges? Who actually knows where the edges of this are? And what does the run picture look like? What does actually running it in anger look like? We can deliver the capability, but can we actually staff to actually achieve what it's supposed to long term? And that isn't a prevalent mindset, funnily enough, I found out. but I used to build teams of people to help me do that.
People freak out when they hear like particular terminology of like taxonomy, and they go, oh my god,
metadata.
Need a taxonomy. What do I do? Metadata, data about data. just think classification. Like, what's a business classification? Well, it's a classification of your business.
I think language is turning out to be quite a dividing factor. So, for example, in IT, archiving means something very, very different to what it means in records management and data protection. Yeah. So, when you're talking with IT people about retention, and they say, "Oh, we archive this, that, and whatever," they have read that there is a special provision for being allowed to keep stuff as long as you're archiving it. You have to explain to them that actually what that means is permanent preservation for historical value in the public interest, not stashing it on a server somewhere. So if they can't explain why they're archiving, then they're not actually speaking the same language, and you're not going to come to a satisfactory conclusion because of it. Emily's going to take issue with my definition of archiving. Sorry, do carry on.
Well, to be honest, I don't know if you heard that war cry from all the archivists around the world. I definitely heard it. It might be my hearing aid that's going off a bit, but, just that concept of archiving as a whole sort of... my fellow cardigan wearers, I'm with you. We are going to get there eventually.
It kind of reminds me of when I was in the military and you couldn't get anything out of stores because stores are for storing. And so you could be wearing rags and in desperate need of a new uniform, but oh no, no, no. If I give it to you, what's going to be on my shelf? And there's that mentality stored up there. But I was with an organisation a little while back, and they have introduced an email archiving solution, and they're now archiving all emails inbound and outbound for 999 years.
What?
And somebody has told them, but that's okay, because archives are exempt from data protection.
Do me a favour.
If you could only see the three faces that have just been presented here at that statement. But it is important, isn't it? And I mean, Emily, you're into records management, and obviously archiving from a records management perspective.
I'm definitely not an archivist. I'm not trained as an archivist. There is a full-on profession for archivists, and I still call on many people to be contacting archivists. Because there is part of my skill set that I am unable to provide advice on. I say the difference between a records manager and an archivist is that archivists like to throw things away, records managers like to keep things. because believe it or not, just because it's all old and fusty doesn't necessarily mean the archives want it.
Yeah, I mean, security people would ideally like to stop you using it altogether. In the bad old days, please don't shoot me. In the bad old days, and I've been known to say it myself, is
the reason you moved away to
it. Yes, pushed. the network's fantastic. Please don't let any users near it. I come from a background of doing desktop support, then desktop engineering, then network administration. I've spent my time sitting with a console cable in a server room at 4 o'clock in the morning trying to fix stuff. And it is, without the access and the influence to get the changes you need to support users, it does end up as a them and us. Mm. And it does become a battle to keep things safe against the daily churn of using a network and IT resources. And I never liked that. I was always trying to build bridges. That's far more where my psychology goes.
I've got thrusted, as I said, into information security, and now I'm no longer in a full-time role, consultant. I still turn up to information security events. Just recently been to B-Sides Liverpool. And I was explaining to people why I was there. I'm the person that's interested in the stuff that you're protecting. So I want to know what it is, the challenges that you have, that perhaps I can assist with. And vice versa. Because if you're spending all of your money on protecting, basically, you don't really know, because you don't know, are you spending the money in the right areas and stuff like that? So I still upkeep my information security hat, so I think I've actually just put in slides for going to B-Sides Delhi, hopefully.
Oh, fantastic.
Maybe might get in on that specific talk.
But actually, information security isn't the same as IT security.
No.
Because information exists in many formats. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of organisations who are storing a lot of paper-based records where information security don't get a look in.
Yeah.
And what you end up with is a warehouse full of boxes of stuff.
So when I worked in the civil service, I was in a triangle, so to speak, of people. That you had the ITSO, the IT manager. You had the DPO, Data Protection Officer, and you had me as the DRO, the Departmental Records Officer. They were all civil service titles. And we worked pretty much in a triad that the IT manager was interested in all things IT security that he could deal with. The Data Protection Officer, she was interested in the personal data. And me as the records manager was interested in anything that had any kind of sensitivity in records as general. So if there was a breach, for example, and it was physical, so nothing to do with the IT security at all, and it had personal data in it, me and the DPO would work on it. If it was personal data, IT security, all three of us would be in on it, because personal data is still the records as far as I'm concerned. If it was not personal data, say it was just sensitive, commercially sensitive or competitive sensitive, then it would be me and the IT security person that would work on it. and we worked in the triad, and it worked really well until one of us went off sick.
So I'm kind of interested in literally and absolutely everything, but especially stuff like psychology, sociology, anthropology, and I see the same things occurring no matter what the discipline, no matter what the professional field. It all comes down to people's attitudes and behaviours and group cultures. And I think recognizing that across how cultural mores might differ across disciplines is really important. So starting by defining the language that we're using is kind of essential to not having an argument later on, because a lot of the arguments that I see, you've got two people saying pretty much the same message, you know, vociferously, but in such differences of terms that they think they're disagreeing, and it all escalates and gets heated and gets personal and emotional and, you know...
Violent agreement.
Yeah. Marina and I quite often have a violent disagreement over how to work out what you've got, why you got it, side of things.
We come
at it from different angles.
If you hear some strange noises or a bit of heavy breathing now and again... we've been joined here today by RM Dog, who has taken a very active interest in our podcast, mainly because I think he thinks the microphone might be edible.
We have to move him away from the mic, though. Both mics at this rate.
But no, it's an interesting point, this whole thing of sort of saying the same thing in different language, but also quite often the conflict that I see in organisations is because they don't know why they've got information in the first place. So if you don't know why you've got it, then, you know, purpose and usage and retention and the security needs of that information are all then disconnected and disjointed from each other.
This is why this is one of the topics on which Emily and I have our most heated debates. We're both looking for the same outcomes in our approach, but our process and our approach is very different. So Emily, take how to even start with data protection. So my view as an as a data protection person is that...
Wear the right hat.
Yeah, this hat. Starting by defining the purposes for which you are processing personal data is absolutely key, because if you start just by counting the data, then you end up with a list of data, but you've still got no idea what you're really doing with it and why. Whereas, so that's more of a sort of anthropology top-down approach, whereas Emily, as a record manager, her approach is more about the records, it's about the data, it's about looking at what you've got, and then they're taking the approach of extrapolating why you've got it and relying on things like the information asset register, which is essentially a list of stuff you've got, but doesn't really address why or the law.
So the way that I look at it is that the information asset register is your dashboard for all of your information. It's your catalogue of everything that you have, and it's a concept that it can be a storage container as well as an individual piece of paper. So whatever your asset is, if it's got value, then it's recorded. Now, I don't agree with the way that the ICO has put out that you should have an information asset register and a ROPA together, because it just makes it so complex.
Witnesses from me and Sarah.
But what I think should actually be is that you have your information asset register on the same spreadsheet. Let's just go with Excel spreadsheet. It's horrendous, you need a proper system, you need to invest, but as a starting point, an Excel spreadsheet so that you can get what columns you want in first, is that you can have a sheet for your information asset register that details all to do with all the systems and all the assets and everything like that, and whether or not it's got personal data or not. Because one thing that really gets me is that people forget about commercial sensitivity, legal sensitivity, policy, managerial, all the things that aren't GDPR but still have the same value and can still give you the same reputational damage in the same system. So even if you've put down a process for personal data, you're not covering it off. it's being missed because it's not on a roper. It doesn't need to be on a roper.
Would somebody like to just have a go explaining to our listeners who may not be fully read up on what a roper is, and just to distill it down into easy language for us?
So a roper is something that the GDPR says that organisations of over 250 people in the workforce processing personal data must have.
What does it stand for though, Rowena?
I was just coming to that. And it stands for Record of Processing Activities. And it's kind of like the blueprint for processing personal data for the organisation. There are things that have to be in it, such as the purpose for which you are processing, the lawful basis associated with that purpose, the data categories, the data subject categories, the recipients, whether it's going to a third country, an indication of how long you're going to keep it. And all of that is absolutely necessary, because when it comes to determining what rights apply in what context and uses of the information, you cannot tell that just by looking at the data. You have to look at the purpose and the context in which it's being used.
I find that things that are missing from ROPA that an organisation really needs are things such as where it's located when you want to find it. Is it subject to FOI? Is there lots of FOI requests that are coming in? Who's the custodian of that information? So they work together.
Yeah.
And you have both personal data and also non-personal data covered.
There's nothing to stop you mirroring the roper for non-personal data, but I think trying to conflate the two and making them the same thing, A, makes it insanely complex and very quickly.
I don't agree with that.
The will to live. My understanding from your earlier comment was that you think that they should be the same.
No, I don't agree with the ICO.
We are totally in agreement then. So yeah, the roper is
makes
a strategic...
stupidly complex.
It is stupidly complex.
Seems we did have violent
agreement.
Violent agreement. We did have violent agreement. Yes.
So you've been desperately trying to get a word in.
I've been waiting for my
arms. Sorry, I want to speak.
So if we could just hand the talking spoon on for a moment.
Sarah has the conch.
It's kind of a middle place between you two, because the way I've seen this tackled in bigger businesses is I've talked to the records managers and I've begged to have use of their asset registers because it's invaluable. And I gained the understanding of a roper, and what has usually happened is there's when it started out of the IT department or the security department, which is often the case because they're the people with the amount of bodies you require to start a piece of work, and the misconception it's mainly about security controls, is that people suck a list of systems out of their CMDB.
Yes.
And they start with a list of IT systems.
Yeah.
Now, IT systems are tin. They are agnostic of the value of what passes through them. Some of them are inherently valuable in terms of availability. They need to be up for business to be transacted, for support to be given, etc. But 9 times out of 10, it's the data on them, be it company information that's not personal, or be it personal information that is also of value to the company as well as individuals. So I spend a great deal of the time talking at a planning level with people about how... knowledge of IT systems is handy, but from a data protection point of view, you have to start with a record of processing activity. You then attach third parties and you attach data assets to that, and you attach the information necessary, and then you say, please miss, may I have the underlying detail out of your records management system so we can get the next tranche of information about whereabouts, etc., into it.
I think the bottom up approach can be very, very risky for the reasons you've described, because personal data may not be personal data when you look at just the item of data itself. Mm. It's only personal data when it's used in a certain context.
Yes.
Or in a certain way. So, for example, an IP address, if you just had an IP address on a poster in the street, it's very unlikely to be personal data. So you can't say IP addresses are never personal data. However, an IP address in a connection log associated with a username and a password and a date and a time, that is part of a set which is personal data. So really, personal data is driven by the purpose for which the data is being put to use, not the intrinsic properties of the data itself. And so starting by looking at the data leaves a huge risk that you're going to miss something that doesn't look like personal data when you look at it in isolation.
But there's an Americanized aspect to that, where...
Did that hurt?
No sense, no feeling.
Used to it.
Yeah, stop hitting the guest mic. So it's personally identifiable information as the terminology that's in embedded in the sort of US-focused branch of similar practice. And that actually does come with a very strict list. Name is a piece of PII, you know, address plus name is a piece of PII.
And
but you've got to empathise a little bit, ladies.
Nope.
No,
we don't.
Maybe
we don't.
That's my role. These guys, they want to program us. Sorry, these people, because it's not all men, because I was one. These people want to program a system to be able to identify person information. And unless you can take a list of fields, it's not going to work very easily. There is a judgment call. It's why I wrote a piece about how much human intelligence effort you have to invest to start making data discovery work. It can't be artificially or otherwise intelligent. It needs people to know what the data means and what it's for. So it's language again. People need to know what they mean by personal information.
I think there's a massive cultural question there as well, though, because it's the kind of the difference between American law freedom to and European law freedom from.
Yes.
And so the sort of cultural approach is that in America, unless it's personal data, where you have to do certain things with it, then you can do anything
better
with
off.
It.
Yeah.
Whereas in European law, it's we want to protect people from tyranny, discrimination. Did I say discrimination
yeah.
twice? Well, that's how important it is.
Exploitation
and all that. And therefore, we are not going to make a reductive list and put a fence around that. We're going to make it about motivation and potential impact. And I think that fundamental cultural difference is causing a lot of friction at the moment, especially since people in Europe are trying to work with systems designed by and for Americans, which just have such a totally different philosophy of privacy that trying to stitch those two together is massively challenging.
Well, I think the concept of public data being a free-for-all is probably a place that typifies that as
yeah.
much as anything else.
Yeah.
If people have been, often it's said, stupid enough to put stuff... I'm sitting already.
He's really insistent on trying to join in the podcast.
You are
because
very handsome.
Michael's trying to fend him off with his legs.
He is
on Twitter as rmdog_UK if anybody wants to follow his antics.
You'll see some pictures of him doing this.
And his yeah. own podcast.
Yes,
his
absolutely.
Own podcast, yeah. Yeah.
Sorry. That's all right, my love. But that personal data, if you're stupid enough in some circles to put data online, it's then you can do anything with it. That actually isn't just a throwaway. That's pervasive. It's understanding, it's making the psychological shift, and it isn't one that you're supported to do in any other field apart from data protection. It doesn't actually serve the purposes of any business particularly right now. If you're supported to make that shift, you then start focusing on what you do with that data, whether it's appropriate for you to have it, the fact you need to protect it, the fact you can't keep it forever. It really is that false equivalency between privacy and secrecy. People are saying, the cat's out of the bag, Pandora's box is open, we're trying to stuff a genie back in the bottle, why should we bother? And we need to get past that. Because really, in their personal lives, every single practitioner who feels like that on behalf of a business to get their job done, protects their own privacy and wants those protections for themselves and their families.
Yeah, I think that's probably very true. I think the drive to make everything quicker, easier and more efficient
yeah.
is essentially a drive towards inhumanity, which can be both a positive and a negative thing.
But we live in a world where we need to do things faster, though.
do we want to live in a world where we can ruin people's lives at scale and speed just because it's easier? I mean, I wasn't
actually really thinking about that. I was more thinking about 72 hours to report. But, you know, about mass destruction.
Yeah, let's go existential.
I think if we were to go back 20 or so years and somebody was to put on the table, you know, the world that we now live in, and effectively, you know, to say all people have to be tracked everywhere they go and they have to check in to let us know who they're with. And they've got to have devices in their homes that are always listening to them and always watching them. When you put it together as a package like that, it starts to feel uncomfortable. And yet, because of the incremental way in which this technological change has happened, we've sleptwalked into this invasive lack of privacy. You know, you've got big tech companies like Facebook who have terms and conditions that effectively say anything you put on Facebook becomes their property and you have no rights.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, that's the world we live in at the moment. And I kind of do agree with Rowena that, you know, we're racing towards a precipice here where the technology companies seem to think that they have more rights over our privacy than we as individuals do.
Yes. Unfortunately, if you look at the current landscape, that assertion is pretty much borne out by what's actually happening. The thing with rights and, you know, freedom is that they have to be constantly maintained, actively demanded and fought for, otherwise they disappear. And we're now so used to demanding convenience and comfort that we've kind of forgotten that it comes at a cost. And at the moment, the cost is things like freedom from discrimination, social mobility, democracy, you know, stuff that's fairly important for happy, civilised society, because we're all trapped in this mesh of pursuing short-term economic goals.
It's in a lot of people's interest for that to be the case as well, that we're divided and we're focused on our own wants.
Without getting the tin foil hat out completely.
I know, I'm keeping it tucked under my arm.
And culturally as well.
Can we make some of those? I've got tin foil upstairs.
We've all got one.
Culturally, there's also a big difference, certainly between the Far East and Europe, but also between America and Europe, between countries with a strong religious participation. The balance of power between the individual and the collective is something that, you know, human beings have never been able to agree on in groups larger than four, pretty much. But
we're asking for world peace and we can't even get Pepsi and Coca-Cola in the same room, the same restaurant.
Exactly. So I think there is far too much convenience, and I don't think that's altogether necessarily a good thing.
I mean, this is something I'm seeing a lot in the physical security world as well. You know, as we race towards new technology like automatic facial recognition, the disconnect between what the technology is capable of doing and what we should be doing morally, ethically, legally. You know, and you've got people like Tony Porter trying to uphold the Protection of Freedoms Act whilst the police are racing towards the use and adoption of technology like facial recognition and body-worn cameras.
Is it Neil Brown who's made the T-shirt with the multiple faces on it?
Yes.
Facial ID. He's actually got a T-shirt with lots of pictures of faces on it. So when facial ID comes in and he just has to wear it, it just picks up on different faces on him.
That's genius.
Really, really good idea.
To your point, Rowena, I think there is always going to be a tension, and I think the tension is nowhere clearer than in the national security debate. And it's the easiest lever to pull. Do you want your kids to be safe or not? No, that's not the conversation. Do you want to allow terrorists to blow things up or not? We all want to try and find a sweet spot, and there isn't one. What we can't do is disable the ability to apply tension on each side. And I think at the moment we're at risk of disabling that ability to apply tension on the public side.
Well, we had similar arguments around the adoption of things like ANPR some years ago.
Yeah.
And one of the arguments there was if we put ANPR on entrances to the country, so on our ports, we'll be able to detect terrorists. Because, of course, terrorists are the ultimate bad guys. And, of course, terrorists are all driving around in vehicles that they have legally registered with DVLA.
Yes, of course.
Absolutely.
Absolutely, yeah. Totally.
That makes me think of hackers all wearing black hoods.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah, you can spot a hacker, because when they walk down the street, they have matrix prefix at the back.
Covered in binary.
And a balaclava.
Yeah, balaclava, black hoods and balaclavas.
But I think there's those different sets of cultural tensions are, it's kind of a fractal landscape, because the more you narrow down, the more you see different cultural tensions, whether it's between organisations or between departments in an organisation or between people. You know, perhaps somebody has an ego-based desire to win the argument and somebody else is arguing for the greater good, for example. Mm-hmm.
In different countries, they have a different definition of what a record is.
Everyone's got a different definition of what a record is.
Well, no, but like, it's actually, like, as in Australia and UK agree, but America don't. They actually have this concept that you make something a record rather than it just being a business dealing or transaction. In the UK, everything is under ISO 15489. I almost forgot. I forgot my own.
That's nerdy angst with a cherry on top there, isn't it?
So 15489, the definition of record is the business transaction, it's everyday use, and so documents and records, there's no really particular definition difference between. But in America, they have this specific thing that everything is a document unless it's made a record. So that's why SharePoint has a record centre, because they move things into being a record. And it's been said, and I don't know how true this is, that FOIs have been turned down on the basis of what the person's asking for is not a record.
Right. Okay.
And I was like, oh, crafty.
That's interesting, because while it would make a lot of people's lives easier if the entire world had one definition and one set of language, I think that would be a bit dull. I mean, you'd lose a lot of cultural concept, you'd lose a lot of independent creative thinking. Yes. So making things easier isn't necessarily making them better.
Mm. Well, but if you've got anything with the C word... Compliance,
which
is, that is.
I was about to say. There you are, it's not our kind of podcast.
I was thinking
you
could say,
get them. I'm racing to turn off the audio.
Where's that button? Where's that button?
I don't know, people treat it the same in some circles I move in. But I've completely lost my point now.
You were talking about compliance.
Compliance.
Oh, sorry, but what was that? Say what you were saying before.
Making things easier doesn't necessarily make
but
better.
You want to standardise. You do want to standardise. Everybody wants to standardise if you're dealing with
but
compliance.
Not too far.
Yeah, actually, I've been taught a lesson by my daughter, because she's really into K-pop. And
what's
she's
that?
Korean pop music, like BTS and stuff like that. I took her to a BTS concert.
What's BTS?
Cool Mom. It's a boy band. A Korean boy band.
I think this is another discussion. I think you have to tell me afterwards.
I'll show you pictures. My sister's really concerned. She's just going to grow up to think all men are that androgynous. But anyway.
Talking of records.
Believe it or not, records management is not about vinyls.
It's not about like structuring your record collection by genre and artist.
Although my DVD collection is A to Z right now.
Oh, excellent. My other half's like that. He helps organising stuff. But no, the culture over there is far more collectivist than our culture. The culture is very much focused on what is for the community good, what is for my family and then my community good. And that isn't enforced. That is just where culturally they come from as artists. You're looking at a picture of BTS.
No, I'm looking at the definition of K-pop right now. But
okay.
Carry on.
All right. So
I'm very disappointed.
That's given me pause for thought about, you know, how far can you take something? To what extent can you influence? And can we, that greater good thing, which I really struggle to say without the accent from Hot Fuzz. not my family, it's never said without the accent.
Say it.
Greater good. I know I can't do it. I come from Norfolk, it's going to go even worse wrong. But yeah, so considering the culture you're working with in all ways, which is what we were saying before, you need to work out how to approach things that respects and works within that culture, nudges from within that culture.
Well, of course, the most important thing about all of this is that we must absolutely lock it down, lock it away, keep it away from users at all costs, and finally, wrap it all up in a big consent.
Yes, it's always got to be consent.
Yeah.
Oh my goodness, like, for those of you who don't see the expressions on our faces, this is all irony and satire.
Consent.
I just want that out there.
I think it should be like a Father Ted moment, so like, consent!
Father Jack.
Go on.
Oh, no, not so, go on. Father
down
Ted.
With
Father
that
Jack,
sort of
yeah.
Thing.
Yeah.
Careful now.
Father Jack. Instead of drink! Consent.
Well, this is where the risk management comes in.
That would be an ecumenical matter.
But it's the oh damn! What I was going to say thing there. I think the differences between the information related disciplines. So you've got records management. You've got knowledge management, which is not the same thing at all. You've got information rights, which is data protection, freedom of information, a bit of that, and boring environmental stuff, don't throw things. You've got information security, and a subset of that, you've got cyber security.
Sorry, the fact you said subset, you're going to be in trouble for
I feel
as well.
Soiled.
Can I just point out, that noise effect does not work on a radio sort of podcast
okay.
kind of thing. It just...
I don't know so much.
I think it was the pizza.
Yeah, well, to be honest, I was... worried there that she was about to spit in my direction. It was just the dirt. She felt dirty just using the cyber. That's another C
word.
Cyber. Yeah.
We're awash today, aren't we?
They're all kind of converging on, you know, ultimately the same place, which is to get stuff done without causing more damage than good, essentially. Mm. Although, you know, damage and good are kind of depending on whose perspective you're looking at it from.
Whose benchmark.
So I think that's something that comes to the front when we see things like the DPIAs. If the DPIAs are being done by security people where their focus is to protect the organisation and to protect the organisation's information, that's not the same as when the DPIA might be completed by somebody who comes from a much purer data protection background, where they are looking to protect the privacy and the rights of the individual.
Yes, I've seen... In fact, I can always tell a DPIA that was written by an InfoSec person because it's mostly focused on confidentiality and risk to the organisation and the mitigations suggested, where there are any, aside from copy-pasta from the vendor's PR material, generally tend to focus on technical confidentiality and integrity controls. And very rarely is the question asked, if we use this in the way we planned and for the purpose we planned, what could the unintended consequences to the rights and freedoms of the data subject be? That question is seldom asked because of the InfoSec mindset having a very different focus. And I think that the lack of that interrogation is quite a serious problem. Certainly, it can be a serious problem for individuals down the line, but for organisations as well. If they're not getting a diverse range of viewpoints, then they're not doing a DPIA. They're doing a paperwork exercise, which is going to end up being a waste of time and effort.
Well, that's quite often where, again, compliance as a mindset, we have to do this in order to tick the box in order for the project to progress. Rather than this is a valuable part of our understanding of risk and compliance and legislative needs, but actually it's also about continuing to respect the data subjects.
Yeah, I mean, something that I used to be a little saying of mine is the question has to be asked and answered. We have to ask the right questions and get an answer to them. That doesn't mean we have to stop doing what we're doing. Your resistance to engaging is slowing all of us up. Let's get on the same playing field.
I always say about DPIAs, if it feels like you're hanging your underwear out in the chief exec's office, then you're doing a DPI right. You need to be doing it so that it shows your absolute most secret things ever, so that you can make a risk-based decision as to whether or not you should carry on doing it.
You can't manage a risk until you express what it is, until you articulate it.
Because you're showing all of these things up, at least as long as you know that that's what's happening. Sorry, Ryan, I put you off.
No, I hadn't realised you hadn't finished, sorry. So many DPIAs are that I see are post hoc rationalizations of decisions that have already made, products that have already been purchased, and this is kind of a last minute, as Mike says, tick box exercise before the go live date, which nobody is prepared to consider postponing, let alone cancelling. And
I got written off someone's Christmas card list because I said that they couldn't go ahead with the system that they wanted.
Good, Christmas cards are an environmental nightmare.
E-card list then. Anyways, I'm off that list. Basically is that I when being shown the demo, they got so far, they were just about to buy it. And I came in and they went, you can't have that. And they went, sorry, what?
Oh, but and you then, didn't just say you can't have that, did you?
I know.
You gave them a risk-based reason why.
I didn't
why.
Phrase it like that. But basically what I did was walk in and say, you can't have that. And the reason why we had to have the... So I was quite short for time, man. was that it was running on Microsoft Access.
Okay.
And I was like, nope.
But it comes down to culture again. So if the organisation does not have a culture of respect for individuals' rights and freedoms, then they're never going to approach a DPIA in the way that it is intended and the law says it needs to be approached. It's only ever going to be a butt-covering exercise. On the other hand, if an organisation does have a truly respectful approach to individuals' rights and freedoms and doesn't want to be a git, then they will do it properly, even with limited resources.
Be a git with such menaces.
But that goes beyond just the data protection element, doesn't it? If they've got the right culture, then they will approach risk in a way that is very open and very informative, rather than writing risk assessments that are designed to justify the decision they want to make.
That's absolutely fundamental. And the focus through the change in vendor assurance done into the data protection and DPIAs has always been in establishing a RACI who's responsible, accountable, consulted, informed, who actually owns that piece of the pie. And you can't be accountable unless you can actually influence things in an organisation. And having that conversation when something has gone wrong or when something is about to go live does not work. You attach the risk appetite to the people. You propose, what do you find tolerable? What is going to be tolerable? And you talk about it before you ever hit the context of a change that their quarterly bonus relies upon.
Yeah.
And you also have a process to record that decision is attached to them. And I think the biggest failing we've got nationally and internationally is that accountability for those risk acceptance decisions, especially in manufactured minimum viable products, does not follow that person after their tenure in an organisation
or into the live environment. The economic models we have are hostile to individuals' rights and freedoms. And so organisations, although some do talk a good talk about privacy being a value and a unique selling point and all that, actually the average buyer just wants cheap and functional as a secondary consideration.
Venn diagram, cheap, fast.
Right, fast or cheap.
Right, fast or cheap, yeah. I love that Venn diagram.
Until there's some way in which organisations that do respect rights and freedoms can be rewarded and organisations that don't punished, kind of all of the rest of the discussion is a little bit academic, because we've got, at the moment, we're trying to use law to rein in economic models. And the argument in return is, oh, but we can't do this because it will ruin the economy.
The one I heard recently was that it was going to break the commercial viability of the internet.
Yeah, that's nonsense.
And actually, do you know what? If the commercial viability of the internet relies on exploitation of our privacy and our rights as human beings, then it deserves to be broken.
I'm pretty sure there was all sorts of objections to discontinuing the slave trade, but we did it because even though there was shed loads of cash to be made, it was the wrong thing to do. And I think that discussion really needs to be had again. But it needs a lot more transparency in order for risk assessments to individual rights and freedoms to be anything more than dismissed as fear-mongering.
When you talk about sort of like transparency side of things, kind of leads me to thinking about like privacy notices and the fact of how terrible some of them can go across. And like sort of like this whole
as you're saying, a book covering exercise around hiding up, showing you've done it. It's kind of like, it's a tick box. We've done the DPIA. It's not been done properly. So therefore, the privacy notice also isn't done properly because they don't actually know. They haven't answered all the questions they needed to answer. So they've kind of gone, that'll do. We may do this. We may do that. May! Don't say may!
You may be kidnapped by aliens.
Yes,
you may. Yeah, and there's usually that final line, isn't there? And anything else we decide to do with it later on in life.
Yeah. It's kind of like that.
Yeah, how transparent is that?
Well, I mean, the law is about locking the stable door after the horse has bolted. It's about repairing your balance sheet. It's not about repairing harms, either to the business... Well, it's repairing harms by legal retorts to sue the people who made it go wrong, but it does nothing to protect individuals.
Well, the idea is in terms of writing contracts
and agreements.
And the law essentially is a mechanism for dispute resolution.
I've spent too much time around contracts recently. That's why I'm talking like this. Not having the law as a benchmark for trying to design processes and systems to make things better.
Well, indeed, it's like that thing on Twitter the other
contract
week.
There was
kids playing a game in a playground that the adults considered to be dangerous and risky, so they banned... I can't remember what it was called. Call it spoons. They banned
conkers.
Spoons.
They banned conkers.
It was a specific game. And so the kids carried on playing exactly the same game, only they gave it a different name. They called it knives. And so the head teacher banned knives. And so the kids carried on playing exactly the same kind of game, only they called it sporks. And that's the attitude we have to law at the moment, in that it is a minimum baseline to be wriggled around as cleverly as possible in pursuit of growth, cost reduction and sustainability in an economic way. But actually, the law is our collective defence against human nature.
Is that not where the fines are for managing directors of organisations? Phoenixing is meant to stop because... the closing of a business to rename it as sporks, to rename it as knives kind of thing. What they're doing is still incorrect, but they're just kind of jumping into another company.
That is part of it. And I mean, there's no such thing as a law that is human-proof. There's no such thing as a human that's human-proof or a technology that's human-proof. But I think the attitude of looking at law as passed in a civilised liberal democracy, not necessarily law that's passed in an authoritarian repressive regime, because that's a whole other thing, but law that's passed in a civilised liberal democracy is essentially the group protecting the group from the acts of the individuals within the group. And I think, well, I mean, I know this isn't taught in schools. I certainly wasn't taught it in schools.
Would you like to know the area of a triangle?
No, but thanks. until there is economic reward for respecting individuals' rights and freedoms, then I don't think we can expect companies to bother. And by that I also mean economic punishment for those who don't. Mm.
Well, that actually is how the slave trade ended. The slave owners were paid off.
Yeah.
They didn't give up slavery out of the goodness of their own heart. maybe it's not a bad analogy that information today is the new slaves, molasses and cotton.
Yeah,
there's a huge amount of money being made out of our information, and not enough of us are standing up for the rights that we deserve.
I'm glad you went there rather than saying that our information, perhaps that's the way to pay us off, to use our information, because I think maybe it's a fundamental point that we haven't got to yet, is the concept that we don't own our information. There's a good reason why we don't own it. It's so we can't sell it or sign over the rights to it for someone else to have ad nauseum and to use however they choose. It's correct, and it's a hard concept to get your head round. We don't and we should not own our information because someone will take it from us.
Some things should never ever be for sale.
Yeah. It's not our information, it is us.
And the concept, obviously, is that nothing is ever free.
Yeah.
Because we are paying for it with our rights and freedoms.
Or even better, somebody else's.
Or somebody else's, yeah.
Yeah. Well, and I think that's probably a really good place to wrap this up today.
Oh, that sounds fun.
I always knew that getting these three amazing people together in the same room to do something like this was going to be interesting, informative, and also great fun. I hope that you've enjoyed listening to it as much as we've enjoyed making it. So all that remains is for me to ask these fabulous ladies just to say goodbye.
Bye.
And a goodbye from our own doctor.
Yes, he's now asleep.
Goodbye from me, and it's goodbye from him.